Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Intellectual Property Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, January 30th, 2018, during a live teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's teleform conference call as today we discuss tribal immunity and patent law. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being transcribed for possible use as a podcast in the future. My name, again, Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. We're very pleased to welcome back a return guest. He's going to act as our moderator and interviewer today. He's Mr. Brian Pandya, partner at Wiley Ryan right here in Washington, D.C. I almost said Brian Wiley Ryan at Fielding. I guess I'm old school, but we're joined by three other experts. So with that, let me turn things over to Brian Pandya. Go ahead, Ryan.
Thank you, Dean. Today's teleforum raises two areas of law that, until this fall, I have never seen intersect: patent law and Native American law. In September 2017, Allergan assigned its patents related to its Restasis eye drops to the St. Regis Mohawk tribe from upstate New York. According to publicly filed documents, the tribe received a $13.5 million upfront royalty payment, is eligible to receive up to $15 million in annual royalties over the life of the patents based on U.S. sales of eye drops, and the tribe granted an exclusive license to Allergan for certain commercial uses in the United States. At the time of this transaction, Allergan had just completed a Hatch-Waxman bench trial in the Eastern District of Texas against three companies that had filed abbreviated new drug applications to market generic versions of Restasis. Those three ANDA filers, Mylan, Acorn, and Teva, also filed numerous petitions for inter partes review at the Patent Trial and Appeal Board, challenging the validity of the asserted patents. Upon executing this license agreement, the Mohawk tribe moved to dismiss the IPR proceedings on the basis of tribal sovereign immunity. The petitioners vigorously opposed this motion, and in what I understand is a first, the PTAB called for amicus briefs on this issue. In yet another twist, the Eastern District of Texas invalidated the patents that were tried. That is on appeal, and we'll see what happens there. But there are still other non-asserted claims still at issue in the PTAB. Joining me today to talk about this issue are three of the nation's preeminent experts in this field. Our first speaker is Michael Shore, founding partner of the Shore, Chan, and DePompo law firm in Dallas, Texas. Michael represents the St. Regis Mohawk tribe in the litigation and at the PTAB. He's also represented a number of other patent holders in offensive patent litigation matters across the United States. Next speaker is Aaron Cooper, who is the Vice President of Global Policy for BSA, the Software Alliance. Before joining BSA, Aaron served as counsel for intellectual property matters for Senator Patrick Leahy on the Judiciary Committee. And our third speaker is Professor Greg Oblavsky from Stanford Law School. Professor Oblavsky is one of the nation's premier experts in Native American law. Now, before we start our discussion, I want to make a few disclaimers. Anything we say today represents the speaker's personal views based on our present understanding of the law and facts. Secondly, there will be a number of hypotheticals, play acting, points taken just to spur debate. So even if we say something, it may just be for the sake of debate, and hopefully we can learn something about this interesting topic and have a spirited discussion. My first question is for Michael. This is the first time that tribal sovereign immunity has been invoked at the PTAB. Tell us how Allergan's deal with the Mohawk tribe came together and why the tribe entered into this transaction.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak in the forum. This all really started back in 2004 when we were representing the University of Texas in a case. It actually went up to the Federal Circuit. It was Tejet Communications versus the Board of Regents of the University of Texas, where we established that sovereigns cannot be sued in a forum that they don't choose for declaratory judgment of non-infringement. So we kind of had that in our back pockets that we had done that for the University of Texas, which basically means that unlike other normal non-sovereigns, if a sovereign threatens to sue somebody on a patent, they can't be held into a court they don't choose for a declaratory judgment action. And the next step in the process was we represented the University of Florida Research Foundation when an IPR was filed against them by Medtronic. And we made the argument that because IPRs were a quasi-litigation or litigation equivalent, we used the FMC Supreme Court case to argue that the University of Florida could not be forced to participate in an IPR, even if they had filed suit against Medtronic in that case in state court. And we won. So that established that sovereigns can't be sued in a venue where they don't choose, and it also established that one of the venues they can't be sued in without their choice is the PTAB. So at that point, we decided that we started looking for sovereigns to take advantage of the huge arbitrage that exists between sovereign and non-sovereign patents. I also represent non-sovereign universities. I represent Caltech, Johns Hopkins, and other premier research institutions. And what I found out was if the exact same patent is held by Caltech, and subject to IPRs, subject to being held into court in a bad venue, those patents may not even be worth asserting because of those, I call them handicaps or disabilities, the disabilities created by the American Invents Act. But if the exact same patent was held by the University of Florida or the University of Texas, it would be enforceable because when I was going into negotiations for my non-sovereign clients, the first thing that the big infringers would sit down and say is, why should I pay you what this patent's worth when I can go file an IPR and I have a 75% of invalidating it and it's only going to cost me $300,000 or $400,000 to invalidate it, so I'll pay you $300,000 or $400,000 or else I'm going to invalidate your patent, have a 75% to invalidate your patent, and you won't be able to enforce it against anybody else. It was basically that grotesque. A situation that we were running into with our non-sovereign clients. So when we realized that there was this huge arbitrage in value between sovereign and non-sovereign patents, we literally said, you know, that's wrong on behalf of our non-sovereign clients. And I'll be honest with you, our goal was not to do anything other than to destroy the IPR process by creating such big loopholes in it that Congress would have to sit down and look at the fact that there's this huge disparity in value between sovereigns and non-sovereigns and fix it. And the way you fix it is by reforming the IPR system to make it more fair so that there's not that huge arbitrage in value between sovereigns and non-sovereigns. So we started with the St. Regis Mohawk Tribe has a general counsel who went to Cornell undergraduate, Princeton undergraduate, Cornell Law School, brilliant guy. He understood the concept, and so our first project that we went to them was, we have a client, SRC Labs, which is SRC is Seymour R. Cray, the founder of the supercomputer. It was a company he started that has a broad patent portfolio. Their biggest clients are the NSA, the CIA, and Defense Department, but you know, Microsoft and Amazon were massive infringers of these patents in their data centers. And so we knew that if SRC, a relatively small company, went after Microsoft and Amazon, that they would face serial IPRs, maybe into the dozens, if not hundreds of IPRs that like have been filed against people like that in the past. So we went and we got a sovereign to basically take title to the patents in exchange for agreeing that they get a cut of the proceeds, agreeing to assert sovereign immunity. And when you do these transactions, you have to grant the sovereign explicit, material, permanent rights. So it can't be a fake transaction. You have to really transfer your intellectual property to the sovereign. The sovereign has to retain substantial material rights. So it does literally become a partnership between the sovereign and the non-sovereign in the holding of the IP. And we went and filed the suits, and lo and behold, you know, the first thing we were told by Microsoft was, you know, darn it, we can't file IPRs. This is the first thing we would have done. Now they have to actually address the merits. So, but before we ever filed the SRC case, when word got out that we were doing this, A friend of ours who works in the pharmaceutical industry, what his role there is to finance royalty streams and to securitize royalty streams for pharmaceutical patents. And his business had basically been destroyed by IPRs. And so he called a friend of his at Allergan and said, I heard about this process. Is this something you guys might be interested in? You have a case pending in the Eastern District of Texas under the Hatch-Waxman process, but you also have these IPRs that are coming up for trial. And Allergan said yes, and so this guy put us together with Allergan. I'd never done a pharmaceutical case before, knew nothing about it. I know a lot more about it now. And so Allergan came to us, and they said, we'd like to explore this opportunity. We have a trial coming up in the IPRs in a few weeks, and we prefer to have the case decided in district court with a real Article III judge, with a jury, with the presumption of validity, a claims construction standard that is the standard that's been used for 70 years, and we don't want to go into this, what they perceived as an unfair forum. And so we gave them a price at which we would charge them to do it, to partner up with them. They agreed, literally, immediately. We made an appearance. The IPR was stopped, and it still has not restarted. And as part of that deal, of course, the tribe said that they were not going to assert any sovereign immunity in the district court. They were going to give the other side the opportunity to invalidate the patents under the traditional rules, the rules that have been in effect for, 100 years. So that's kind of how that happened. But the whole basis of this is that the tribe and the other sovereigns that we work with, their view is that what the rules that apply to sovereigns should apply to everybody. And the goal of this project from our is to take the insanity of the IPR process, where no patent is presumed valid, no matter how much you've invested in it, no matter how much work you've done on it. The whole basis of the patent system is built on the presumption of validity. If a patent's not presumed valid, it has no value. And to try to get either Congress to reform the IPR system, to take out the abuses that the infringer lobby managed to get in there, or create such a loophole in it for that anyone can go to a sovereign, whether it's a state sovereign or a tribal sovereign, and basically get in a time machine and go back to 2011, when the United States patent system was ranked the number one patent system in the world, whereas today I think we're number 10, tied with Hungary and falling. To go back to 2011, when the average patent value was $680,000, instead of today where it's $200,000+ and dropping. We have literally destroyed the U.S. patent system over the last 5 or 6 years, or at least put it in a coma. And what we're trying to do is take us back to a time when we had the number one innovative economy in the world. And that's the goal. And if that's the only thing we accomplish, then I will retire a very, very happy and satisfied person.
Craig, are there any historical parallels to Native American tribes entering into transactions like what Michael just described?
So these sorts of transactions are relatively recent. The concept of tribal sovereign immunity has deep roots. I mean, it dates from a series of cases from the mid-19th century. The very first case is actually from 1850. But these sorts of efforts to try to explore business opportunities made possible by tribal sovereign immunity, they are more recent, I would say, the last couple decades. The big thing, obviously, prior to these transfer of patent rights were the payday lending cases, where tribes would partner with payday lenders who would supposedly set up shop on the reservation and attempt to use tribal sovereign immunity or sometimes the jurisdictional claims of tribes with respect to state usury laws. And we've seen mixed results with that. I mean, one thing that's important to stress is how much these efforts by tribes have grown out of Supreme Court case law that really dates from the sort of mid-late 80s right up through the present, that has substantially curtailed the ability of tribes to exercise taxation powers. So tribes, first of all, tribes usually located in isolated remote locations to begin with, facing a very difficult extract much tax revenue from their own citizens. But increasingly, Supreme Court precedent has said that it's very difficult for them to tax non-Indian businesses that locate on reservations. And on top of that, when they do have those powers to tax non-Indian businesses that set up there, they actually are restricted. The states can also tax those businesses as well. So it makes it very unfavorable for businesses to set up on a reservation because there's this prospect of double taxation. So tribes are really have to look to other models of economic development to secure any kind of revenue that they can to support the services to supply their citizens who, are of tremendous needs. And so these sorts of business developments are part of broader tribal strategies to pursue various kinds of models of economic development that because taxation streams have been foreclosed to them through Supreme Court decisions.
Why have court decisions been skeptical of, these transactions, or why have they limited the power of Native American tribes to levy taxes and exercise their immunity?
Well, those are two separate questions. The taxation question revolves around jurisdictional questions, and without giving you, I don't want to bore you with the very long, convoluted history, but basically it traces back to the early 80s, the Supreme Court decided a case called Montana that substantially limited the power of tribes to exercise civil jurisdiction over non-members within their territories. And there's been a whole subsequent line of cases attempting to interpret that. But one of the consequences of that is it substantially limits the taxation power, which is regarded in these cases as sort of a subset of civil regulatory power. And then there's also been a concomitant line of cases that expanded the power of states within the limits of Indian country. So that's a separate question from the question of tribal sovereign immunity. In fact, what's remarkable is that even as the court has cabined the scope of tribal jurisdiction, it has largely declined repeated invitations to limit tribal sovereign immunity as recently as 2014 in the Bay Mills case. The court reiterated its commitment to tribal sovereign immunity as a foundational principle of federal Indian law.
This is Michael. There's one quick point that everyone needs to understand is that tribes do not own their reservations. So a lot of people think that an Indian tribe owns the property upon which its reservation sits. They don't. That property is owned by the federal government, and the tribes are simply allowed to occupy it. So it's difficult to tax something, a property, personal property, or real estate, if you are not actually the sovereign over the land itself, which the tribes aren't.
Yeah, and I would add, this is Greg again. I would add also that a lot of the land is also now, so back in the late 19th century, Congress decided it was going to privatize a lot of the land within reservation boundaries. And this is what is known as allotted land. And most of that land has passed into non-Indian hands. And it's nearly impossible for tribes to tax that land as well. So Michael's right, the sort of property base that you'd ordinarily rely on is severely limited because tribes really can't tax much of the land that is held in trust, that's foreclosed, nor can they tax the fee land within the reservation as long as it's owned by non-Indians.
One of the exceptions to tribal immunity, though, is if Congress has passed a statute of general applicability. And Aaron, if I can ask you to speak on that topic, but also address, Michael mentioned the FMC case, which I think the famous words in there were walks, talks, and quacks like a duck, or something along those lines, a memorable Justice Scalia quote. But the point Michael was making is that IPR proceedings are adjudicative proceedings. They're like a district court. And in BSA's brief, your amicus brief, you highlighted how that's not the case. So Aaron, can you tell us a little bit about your view on why the American Vents Act is a statute of general applicability, the reasons why it was passed, and then describe the IPR process to our audience and how it is like and how it differs from district court?
Yes, thank you. So I think, first of all, the Patent Act in general is an act of general applicability. It applies across the board to everybody, similar to other statutes that have been found to do the same, like the National Labor Relations Act and so on. I think that at the outset, Michael made some really helpful points about what the overall objective is in raising concerns about how the IPR system works and the objective of trying to get rid of the IPR system. I think he also lays out a good roadmap as to how that's supposed to be done, which is going to Congress and getting Congress to change the statute. I think that is what happened in 2011 when what used to be called the interparty reexamination process, which was a way for a third party to go to the PTO and say, here are the reasons that this patent at issue should not have issued in the first place. And as long as the petition raised a substantial new question of patentability, the PTO would review the validity of the patent and make a determination as to whether it should remain valid. And because there were problems in that process, which I can talk about in a little more detail in a minute, one of the things that Congress did in 2011 in the American Invents Act was to listen to all the parties that raised concerns with the way the interparty reexamination process was working, talk to the PTO about how they could go through the process more quickly and more fairly, and came up with what is now referred to as the IPR process, which is what's giving a concern here. When the interparty reexamination process was in place prior to 2011, one of the things that people forget a lot is that the institution rate for IPRs, for interparty reexamination, was something around 95%. So the 75% number that gets thrown around today is substantially lower. But the problem that the former system had was that while interparty reexaminations were always instituted by the PTO, they were very rarely concluded. And so parties on both sides, both those that are off that we've referred to on the call as the infringer side and those on the patent owner side, all had a concern with the way the process leading up to 2011 was working. And as a result, they made changes in order to raise the threshold for instituting an interparty reexamination, but also give the PTO the tools that it needed, that it told Congress it needed, in order to complete the IPRs in a timely fashion. I think that to the extent that there are concerns about how the IPR process currently works, they are best addressed to the PTO for its rulemaking authority, which is given to them in the American Invents Act, and if that's insufficient, then to Congress. But to try to find ways around having to comply with the same kind of validity checks that everybody else has to go through is where we have concerns.
And this is Michael Shore again. This is not new. The cases with Native American tribes in the patent system having different rules for Native American tribes go back to the early 2000s. For example, there's a case called Home Bingo Network versus Multimedia Games out of the Northern District of New York, which is where the St. Regis Mohawk tribe exists, that held that Indian tribes cannot be sued for patent infringement. That was also upheld in the Specialty House of Creation versus Quapaw Tribe case out of the Northern District of Oklahoma, and nobody in Congress cared. No one sought to overturn tribal sovereign immunity, but literally a tribe can infringe anyone's patent that they want to, and they cannot be sued for patent infringement. So the only reason why this came up and became such a crazy overreaction was because it was an Indian tribe and a pharmaceutical company. When we won the decision for the University of Florida that said state universities or state sovereign entities cannot be hauled into the IPR process, nobody cared. There was very little press outside of the technology transfer university community. But when an Indian tribe did exactly the same thing, people went nuts, and that shocked us. I mean, I thought it was very strange, and then maybe it was because it was a pharmaceutical company in an Indian tribe, but there's never been any uproar over tribes not being subject to infringement suits. There's never been any uproar over universities not being subject to IPRs. All of this only came to a crazy head when an Indian tribe did exactly the same thing that other 11th Amendment state sovereigns were doing. I find that perplexing.
This is Aaron again. So I can't speak to why there wasn't more discussion in the press and in the media about either the Florida case or other cases, or don't represent the pharmaceutical industry, but the pattern that was beginning to form of companies trying to avoid review of their patents at the PTO is what has, at least within the industry that I work with, has raised concerns. And in the other cases, there wasn't an opportunity at the PTO to provide amicus briefs. There was in this case, and I think that's why, and certainly that's why we see filings in it. I think the concern is broader, and it applies in the IPR context differently than it does when there's an infringement by a sovereign, whatever form of sovereign. And one of the reasons, and it gets to Brian, the second half of Brian's question before, is that unlike in an infringement suit, there's no remedy against the sovereign in this case. It is purely a question of whether the patent remains valid. There are no damages, there's no injunction. It's not the same as it's not the same equities as there is in a civil action where there is a legal remedy.
This is Michael Schroer. That's not true. The any infringer has a right, if they are sued, to counterclaim in the district court and to seek to have the patent invalidated in district court. They also have the ability, if they can get the judge convinced that it's a weak patent, they have the ability to ask the judge to hear validity first and to put off infringement and damages for a later day, and that often happens. The problem with IPRs and the problem with how they've been instituted is the rules grossly favor infringers. And I'm in the trenches every day. I sit with multinational giant companies, and the only thing an economic monopolist like Microsoft or Apple or what these guys fear is a patent monopoly. So like any other economic monopolist, they sat down and said, well, the one thing we fear is a patent monopoly, so what can we do? Well, let's destroy the U.S. patent system, because frankly, they're not U.S. companies. They're multinational companies. They have no loyalty to this country. What they have loyalty to is profits. And they're not afraid of little patent troll nuisance suits. Those suits, on average, were settled, and I've got the documentation for those, were settled on average for about $250,000 to $300,000 a case prior to the American Invents Act. After the American Invents Act, guess what they're settling them for? $280,000 to $350,000. And you say, well, why? Because an IPR, to file it and get it through to a trial in the patent, the PTAB, costs between $350,000 to $500,000 on average, and you have an 85% chance of winning. Any economist is going to tell you that instead of paying a nuisance guy $350,000 to $500,000 for an 80% chance, they're still paying them the $250,000 to $350,000 for 100% resolution. So IPRs were sold as a mechanism to fight nuisance, bad patent cases. That was a lie. What it was for was to protect economic monopolists from patent monopolists for good patents. What Microsoft and Amazon and Apple and these guys fear is not a lousy patent case. They know they're going to either win at trial or they're going to win on appeal, or they can settle those cases cheaply. What IPRs were designed to do was to take good patent cases, real innovators, real companies, real products, and destroy them through economic power. For instance, there is actually one case, and it's unbelievable, one little company, a 10-patent company, had 125 IPRs filed against their patents. Because what your audience also needs to understand is there is no limit on the number of IPRs that can be filed against a patent. So it's like owning a house where you can never quiet title. Who would ever want to own such a house? Who would ever buy such a house? The presumption of validity is the only thing that makes a U.S. patent valuable. There is nothing else about a U.S. patent that makes it valuable. If it's not presumed valid, it has no value. And patents are not presumed valid in IPR proceedings.
Yeah. So that's. I think there are a few inaccuracies there that I at least want to highlight and then talk about whether I've got it wrong. But initially, when the AIA was passed in 2011, the organization that supported the changes to the IPR system was the pharmaceutical industry. It wasn't the tech industry. And in fact, the tech industry, when the bill went from the Senate to the House, was opposing the AIA until the House made a few changes so that they would back off and not oppose it. But it was the pharmaceutical industry that liked the higher standard for instituting an IPR relative to the way the interparty reexamination system worked that was the one that was pushing it forward. So it the purpose of the IPR system that was in the AIA was actually the reverse of the way that you're describing it. And the interparty reexamination process that existed up until the AIA was enacted and the IPR rules went into effect had no presumption of validity either. Neither does ex parte reexamination today. And those review processes existed from 1984, maybe 1981 on. So it's been many years where there's been no presumption of validity. The changes that were made were in order to make it harder to institute an IPR, easier to get through the IPR process, but harder to institute. It was also important that there be the ability of the PTO to establish rules that would limit serial challenges. So if there are 125 challenges against one patent, either it's a really bad patent and somebody has tried to sue 125 companies on it, or if the IPR process is being misused, this is exactly why Congress gave the PTO the authority, not just to institute rules, but also to institute sanctions against those who were abusing it. So I think that there are ways that we can, that everybody can work together to try to make sure that the process works for both the patent owner and the patent user side. But it's a little bit of revisionist history to suggest that the way the IPR process works today was because the technology sector was pushing it when it was really the patent holder side.
This is Michael Shaw. I'll give two corrections. One, the pharmaceutical industry is not a monolithic thing. There's the generic side and there's the branded pharmaceutical side. They're all obviously massively at odds over patents and how patents work. And the main difference between an IPR and an ex parte re-exam is in an IPR, you have a party who is spending huge amounts of time and money to invalidate a patent for commercial gain. Whereas in the ex parte system, you do not have the participation of a third party who has massive economic gain to try to destroy the patent system. What you have is you just simply go back to an examiner. So that's a non-analogous comparison.
But there was an inter-party reexamination system.
It was a disaster too, because no one could ever end it. Some of those things would drag on for 6 or 7 years.
Yep. That, I mean, and that's what the branded pharmaceutical side, which is what I was referring to, that is why they wanted to see changes. They wanted to see a heightened standard in order to institute an IPR, and they didn't want it to be gamed by filing at the last minute in the course of litigation and then having the IPR last for 6 or 7 years.
Well, that is absolutely true, because the IPR would last, or the inter-parties review, which is different from an IPR, would last almost, you'd almost have it guaranteed to last until the expiration of the patent.
Shift gears a little bit. We'll come back to this at this point. I do have some questions about serial petitioning. We also are going to open the floor for questions from the audience in about 5 or 10 minutes. So if anyone has questions, please get in the queue. But I do want to ask you, we mentioned earlier that there have been at least three cases at the PTAB dealing with state universities where the PTAB has found that the universities as state instrumentalities could enjoy sovereign immunity. The cases involved the University of Minnesota, the University of Maryland, and the University of Florida. A question for Greg, is there a difference between sovereign immunity that's enjoyed by Native American tribes and the immunity that's enjoyed by states or state universities? And one thing I want to specifically hone in on is whether they both flow from the 11th Amendment or whether there's a different basis, a different rationale for recognizing the immunity and abrogating the immunity.
Sure. Well, so tribes are not encompassed within the 11th Amendment. But I would also point out that a lot of the state sovereign immunity case law has gone far beyond certainly the text of the 11th Amendment as well, right? I mean, tracing all the way back to the 19th century, Hans versus Louisiana, more recent decisions like Alden versus Maine, very clearly not grounded in the text of the 11th Amendment. In fact, the court said that it was more focused on sort of the history and structure of the Constitution. So tribal sovereign immunity does not have that constitutional hook. in the same way that state sovereign immunity does, but it is rooted in some of the same ideas, right? That this idea, tracing back again to the origins of the United States, that sovereigns cannot be sued without their consent in another jurisdiction or in their own courts. And it was based on a reasoning that thought of Native peoples as distinct nations that enjoyed rights of sovereignty, an idea that actually has persisted to the present and accounts for the distinctive status that Native nations enjoy within U.S. law now. So if we think about why sovereign immunity exists, what are the justifications that usually get put forward in the present? People usually point to questions about both the dignity of the sovereign and then the question of the sovereign's finances. And I actually think both of those rationales apply maybe even with greater force in the context of tribes than they do with the context of states. I don't think I need to go into great detail about the long-standing history in which the United States often denigrated and attacked tribal sovereignty and tribes as nations. And so it's pretty clear that tribal dignity is hugely important to tribes and to advance in the U.S. legal system. And then in terms of finances, you know, tribes' financial situation is much more precarious than states in most cases. So though if you hone in on those two rationales as to why sovereign immunity should exist, then arguably they apply with as much or maybe even greater force in the tribal context than they do in the state sovereign immunity context.
Yeah, this is Michael again. I mean, the interesting thing about tribal sovereigns is they're known as, depending on the vernacular uses, dependent sovereigns. And what that basically means is just like Congress can pass a law that abrogates the sovereign immunity of the United States of America, they can also pass a law that abrogates the sovereign immunity of dependent sovereigns to the United States of America, which includes tribes. So Native American sovereign immunity is more precarious than state sovereign immunity, meaning that Congress can change it. For the Congress to change state sovereign immunity, they would either have to go through a very convoluted analysis under the 11th and 14th Amendment, which is very difficult and almost impossible, or they'd have to amend the Constitution. And also you'd have to have senators and congressmen voting in the context of what we're talking about. They'd have to my Texas congressmen and senators have to come back and tell all the people at the University of Texas and Texas A&M that, oh, by the way, I abrogated your sovereign immunity in the patent context in favor of Microsoft. That would not go over well. So it's much easier to abrogate tribal sovereign immunity. But on the flip side, tribal sovereign immunity is much broader than state sovereign immunity. When you have a case where a tribe files a case, the only counterclaims that can be asserted against the tribe are counterclaims that offset the tribe's claims. Whereas against a state sovereign, you can file any compulsory counterclaim, whether it's an offsetting counterclaim or not. So tribal sovereign immunity is actually better, broader, but more precarious. And that's why a lot of my non-sovereign university clients are going to team up with sovereign universities to help protect their patents. And a lot of other companies are talking about going to historically black colleges and universities that are state sovereigns and helping them because they need the money. But a lot of them are saying they'd rather team up with the state sovereigns because it's a much harder to abrogate their immunity. In some ways, maybe impossible. Whereas, although the tribal sovereigns may have broader immunity and better immunity, it's more politically susceptible to being abrogated.
Question for you, Aaron. Does BSA view state immunity, state sovereign immunity, and tribal sovereign immunity differently? And relatedly, if this is a hypothetical, so I realize it's. We'd have to have a specific situation, but would BSA have viewed the situation differently if Allergan or if the tribe had co-developed the patent, or if this was in effect a university text transfer office where the research was done by the tribe or done by members of the tribe, and then it was assigned or was licensed to a company like Allergan, rather than the opposite situation we have here, where Allergan developed the technology, commercialize the product, and then license the patent to the tribe. Does that distinction make a difference?
No, I think the key issue is that this case is an example. The patented issue was used in an infringement suit, and I think that's the key. And so the University of Minnesota case, for instance, where the PTAB recently decided that because the patent at issue was being asserted in an infringement suit, that it therefore waived state sovereign immunity, I think is an important result. And that I think the issue that we want to try to avoid is ways that anybody can game the system in order to avoid the law that Congress passed. There might be reasons to want either Congress or the PTO to revise the way those rules work, but we want to try to avoid workarounds where anybody on either side of the system, whether the patent owner or an alleged infringer, is avoiding the rules that Congress laid out. And it has happened before that in the state sovereign immunity context, that where state has been sued for patent infringement and won and successfully asserted state sovereign immunity, that Congress stepped in and did try to override the sovereign immunity decision. That was also held unconstitutional. But it is the case that even where it is about state sovereign claiming sovereign immunity, that Congress will step in from time to time to try to avoid a gaming of the system.
Yeah, the law on abrogating state sovereign immunity is really tough. And what the law is, you can't abrogate sovereign immunity for a state as a condition of participating in a lawful activity. For example, asserting your patent is a lawful activity. So you can't say that by asserting your patent, you waive sovereign immunity, because that violates Supreme Court precedent. That recent decision of the PTAB in the University of Minnesota case is frankly a joke. You have three administrative patent judges, and I hate to call them judges because they're not judges, but you have three Article I bureaucrats who are going to try to change constitutional law so they can preserve their jobs and preserve the PTAB's role in basically destroying the U.S. patent system. But that the University of Minnesota, who, by the way, I helped write their original brief and will be helping them on the appeal, that is a joke. It will have zero no court is going to give that any deference on appeal. It violates literally three Supreme Court cases, multiple Federal Circuit cases. The law is, in fact, I made the law in the Tejik case for UT, that when you file, because UT had filed in Austin, that when you file in one forum, you do not waive your sovereign immunity to any other forum. That is law. And so the idea that filing a patent infringement lawsuit in Texas waives your sovereign immunity to a different proceeding at the PTAB is ridiculous, and it will not hold up, and it will not be – it has 0% chance on appeal to hold up.
I think critics, though, would say that of your position, Michael, is that by asserting a patent, you have subjected that patent to scrutiny. And if you believe that the PTAB is an in rem proceeding where the patent that you put at issue is being litigated, now you've waived waived any ability to prevent that from being challenged in the PTAB. I mean, Greg, is that what? Can you maybe give us some color or some context? And I'll give Michael a chance to respond, and Aaron chime in too. But Greg, can you historically, how have courts viewed the waiver issue of tribal sovereign immunity?
Well, there are two questions there. So one is this question about in rem proceedings, which is actually interesting and important. And the Supreme Court actually just granted cert in a case out of Washington State involving real property, and the question there is whether tribal sovereign immunity applies to an in rem proceeding, and then if so, if the tribe is an indispensable party, that would mean that the sovereign immunity would prevent the proceeding from going forward. The Washington Supreme Court, I think, somewhat dubiously held that on both counts that the proceeding could go forward because it was an in rem proceeding and that the tribe was not an indispensable party. So that will be interesting to see how that plays out and could have important consequences here. With respect to waiver, the case law is pretty clear. The tribal waiver has to be explicit and unequivocal. The courts have generally been loath to find implicit waiver. There has to be some affirmative waiver on the part of the tribe in order for the court to apply to sort of move a step beyond tribal sovereign immunity.
Yeah, and when it comes to filing a patent infringement lawsuit, you do waive if you're a state sovereign. You absolutely waive compulsory counterclaims. Well, compulsory counterclaims include claims to have the patent held invalid. So there is a forum to have the invalidity decided. By not allowing it to go to an IPR, you're not robbing the infringer of the ability to prove that the patent's invalid. You're just telling him instead of going to three bureaucrats who get paid to invalidate patents, he has to go to an Article III judge. They have to go to a jury under the Seventh Amendment to our Constitution. They have to have the standard for interpreting the patent is the person of reasonable skill in the art, not the broadest possible interpretation that the PTAB uses. You have all kinds of the protections, and you have a presumption of validity, and you have to prove invalidity by clear and convincing evidence. None of those protections exist at the PTAB because the PTAB wasn't designed to get to the same result as district court faster. It was designed to get to a completely different result. District courts invalidate about 26% of the patents that they see, and because they're doing it under the standards that have existed that protect the expectations of patent holders. The PTAB invalidates about 80% of the patents they see. So clearly, this IPR process was not set up to get to the same results more efficiently. It was set up to destroy the patent system, and they've done a darn good job of doing it. Because, again, we've gone from the number one patent system ranked in the world to number 10 and falling, and patent values have dropped from an average of $600,000 to about $200,000, and they're falling. And so no one needs to pretend for a minute that this has anything to do with efficiency, that this has anything to do with getting to the same results quicker. This has everything to do with economic monopolists trying to destroy the one thing they fear, which is a patent monopoly.
I don't know. If it were set up initially in order to invalidate patents and destroy the patent system in general, it's an odd thing for the branded pharmaceutical industry to have supported as better than the standard that existed at the time. And if we've gone downhill in terms of the ranking somebody is giving on the U.S. patent system from the time the IPR system came into effect in 2012, to now, it's odd that prior to that, we didn't have the problem when both through an ex parte re-exam and through inter-party re-exam, there was no presumption of validity and 95% or so of challenges were accepted by the board. I'm as happy to be critical of bureaucracy as the next person, but it's that same bureaucracy that grants the patent in the first place. I don't know that it's fair to be critical of them when they're reviewing their decisions later on than when they first decided to grant the patent in the first place.
Well, the problem with that logic is you apply for a patent, you pay your issue fee, you pay your maintenance fee, you invest hundreds of thousands or millions or tens of millions of dollars in research and development supporting the patent, you go out to investors and you raise money based upon the presumption that that patent is valid, and that you're going to be able to compete with the big guys with patent protection. And then years later, when you're finally successful and your product is successful and you're making money and you're threatening the big guys can come in and throw your patents into a process. Years later, after all of your expectations have been met, years later, and destroy you in under a system where literally the person who is deciding your case can have formerly worked for the person challenging your patent, can formerly have been a lawyer for the person challenging your patent, who gets paid more the more patents they kill, who's not subject to the code of judicial conduct, the person who was put in charge of implementing this process. And a lot of promises were made that the regulations that were going to be implemented were going to be fair, that people were going to be able to amend their patents to preserve their validity. And the person they put in charge of all this, Michelle Lee, the former person at Google, who is in charge of Google patent strategy, gets to be the person who makes the rules and hires the executioners, also known as administrative patent judges, to kill patents. So this is putting one of the greatest economic monopolists in the world, a group that hates patents, in charge of the system to review patents. And they paid $38 million in lobbying to Congress in the 2 years before Michelle Lee got put in that job. And, you know, and then we get panel stacking. We get all kinds of horrors of horrors. So anybody who looks at this with an open mind and opens their eyes, why would you put an economic monopolist like Michelle Lee in charge of the U.S. patent system for a company that has an 82% market share in their business. The only thing Google fears.
But Michael, I don't represent Google. They're not a member of BSA. But Michelle Lee also was not the director of the PTO during the implementation of the AIA. It was Dave Kapos, who I think did a fantastic job. He came from IBM, represents all both patent owners and users at this point, McCravath. But I think everybody gave him great marks for the way he ran the PTO on both sides of these issues. He's the one that was in charge when these rules were put in place. He was the one that was there during the formulation and the enactment of the AIA. And it's convenient to come in with Google, and again, don't represent them, so I'm not here to defend them. But it's just not the case that a former Google employee was in charge of the PTO at that time.
That's absolutely not true. She was named the head of the PTO in 2012. The AIA was passed in 2011. It didn't actually go into effect. The IPRs didn't actually go into effect until 2012. And all of the judges from between 2012 and 2016 that were hired by Michelle Lee. She's the one who hired them. She's the one who set their pay. She's the one who determined, and by the way, this will really kind of, hopefully this kind of freaks out the audience here. If you pay a bunch of money to file an IPR, and the IPR is instituted, well, you don't get your money back. But if you pay a fee, a multi-$1,000 fee to file an IPR, and they don't institute, they refund your filing fee. So of course they're going to institute. I mean, so what kind of a system of justice is where a challenger to a patent, if you pay a filing fee, and if they institute the review to invalidate the patent, they keep your filing fee, but if for some reason they don't, they'll give you your money back. This is the insanity that is the IPR system. If you describe this to a person on the street, and didn't tell them what country it was, they would think it was Venezuela or Cuba or something. But the way this thing is set up, it's an embarrassment to our country. It's an embarrassment to our Constitution. And, you know, I'm an evangelical about this, but I either want to kill it or massively reform it. And the more we get the word out to people, hopefully the quicker that'll happen.
Is your criticism, Michael, the clear and convincing evidence standard, I mean, is that, if that was used at the PTAB, would that reform it? I mean, it's why isn't the Federal Circuit doing more? I mean,
that is a great question, because again, during the 8 years of the Obama,
let me rephrase the question. I just want to be clear. I mean, is your premise that if clear and convincing standard was applied, that would have a different outcome? Then, relatedly, if these administrative patent judges are getting it wrong, the Federal Circuit would presumably be reversing them. So why isn't this just a case that these are self-selecting things? The $40,000 filing fee is a high barrier to entry, and if you're a petitioner filing an IPR, you're filing in a case where you have a great probability of invalidating the patent. You found great prior art. You made a great obviousness combination. Why is that? I mean, why isn't this just a case of a self-selecting example? And, you know, I'll hear you out if you want to say that the
First of all, a $40,000 fee is not a barrier to entry if you get your money back if you're not successful. So there is no barrier to entry.
It's a partial refund. You don't get your expert fees back. You don't get your attorney's fees back. I mean, it's not. I mean, I hear you. If it's a multi-million-dollar case, maybe that's. Every client has their own determinations, but these are not trivial decisions to file an IPR. These aren't cheap proceedings to institute.
Well, and again, so that also goes against the whole reasoning that this was to do away with frivolous cases, because it's not a cheap and easy way to do it. You can get rid of frivolous cases by paying less money to get rid of the frivolous case than filing the IPR. So that's just proving my point. The reason why the Federal Circuit is not reversing a lot of these is because the standards – in the IPR context are different. There is no clear and convincing standard. The broadest reasonable interpretation is used to look at claims instead of what a person of ordinary skill in the art would do. What would a scientist in the field, how would a scientist in the field interpret the claims is how the district court looks at it. the PTAB looks at IPRs as saying, what's the broadest interpretation we can come up with? It's ridiculous. So you lose your clear and convincing evidence standard. You lose your person of ordinary skill in the art interpretation of the claim standard. You lose your jury trial and all the protections that come with the Seventh Amendment jury finding. You don't get those. You don't even get to present the cross-examine the experts at the IPR hearing. So in other words, all of the expert testimony that's presented is presented in writing. It's in a transcript. So for example, they're making credibility determinations on experts without even seeing the experts in the room. To give you an example, if I was in a deposition and I was asking an expert, what do you think this patent is valid based upon X or Y? And let's say live, he rolls his eyes, he looks over at the other lawyer, he shrugs his shoulders, he's fiddling with his feet, and then he looks down and goes, well, yes. Whereas on the transcript, it just says yes. So you cannot have a meaningful cross-examination of an opposing expert in a declaration that's drafted by an attorney. It's not possible. So all the protections of a trial, you get none of them. And they're going to take away your property, which I believe a patent is private property. You paid for it. You paid maintenance fees for it. It's like if you bought a ticket to go to Yellowstone, you show up at Yellowstone and they tell you the park's closed and won't give you your money back. This is fundamental due process to protect the taking of property by the government on behalf of a third party. Because remember, what the government is doing here, this is not supposed to be a substitution for ex parte reexamination. It's not supposed to be a substitution for inter parties review. It's supposed to be a substitute for district court litigation. And if you're going to have a substitute for district court litigation, it needs to have all the due process protections of district court litigation, or it is a false substitute. And that's what it is. It's a false substitute. And if it's okay in this country for the government on behalf of one private property to destroy the private property of another individual solely for the economic benefit of the infringer, there's no economic benefit to the government. If anything, there's an economic detriment because they don't get maintenance fees anymore. They don't get anything related to that. So there's no benefit to the government of invalidating these patents. It is an act of the government to take private property, to destroy private property on behalf of another third party without due process. Now, if you want to give me due process, I can live with it. You want to give me all the protections I have in district court, I can live with it. You want to give me a jury of my peers, I'll live with that. But don't tell me that an IPR by a bureaucrat who's a lawyer who is free the day after they rule against you, they're free to go work for the company that they just ruled in favor of. They're not covered by the Judicial Code of Ethics and Conduct. They're not governed by anything other than what the PTO director wants to govern them by. This is nuts. And anyone who looks at this objectively knows it's horribly broken. And either fix it, or if you want to say that what we're doing is an end run around it, great. I'm end running around a horrifically unfair process. I'd rather you fix it. But if you're not going to fix it, you're darn right I'm going to end run around it. I'm going to figure out every possible way to end run around it.
So I got to say, a lot of the issues that you raised there at the end are they apply with equal force to a patent examiner. A patent examiner, the day after granting a patent to company A, can turn around and say, hey, would you like to give me a job? So it happens. I mean, that issue exists on both sides. I got to say, the IPR process is not intended to be solely a cheaper way of avoiding litigation. It is intended, and in fact, it explicitly did replace the inter-party reexamination process that used to exist. Struck all of that, put in a new process. And that new process was designed not just to be a cheaper alternative to litigation, it was intended to be a more effective quality control mechanism for the PTO, sitting alongside the first window post-grant review process and the ex parte reexam process, all of which have the same issues that you've identified of using broadest reasonable interpretation, not having a presumption of validity, and in the case of ex parte reexamination has been around for 50 years, or 40 years. So I think a lot of these things have existed before, and if they're being applied in ways that aren't the most efficient for the overall economic purpose of the patent system, then there should, as you suggest, be a good discussion at the PTO and if necessary in Congress in order to fix it. but we don't get the dynamic efficiencies that the patent system is supposed to provide if we're granting monopolies and allowing them to persist on claimed inventions that are not true inventions, that are not actually new, novel, and non-obvious. And that's what the ex parte system was intended to clean up. That's what the former inter-party reexamination process was supposed to clean up. And that's what IPR is for.
That is not true. And everyone who's involved in this process knows it's not true. The Inspector General of the Patent Office did a review of patent quality. And they found in 2015 that 8% of the patents issued by the Patent Office were not of high enough quality that they should have been issued. 8%. 80% are invalidated in IPRs, 10 times more. So this is not a mechanism to get rid of bad patents. And by the way, I've been litigating patents for 25 years. Bad patents do not survive district court litigation. 26% of patents do not survive district court litigation. So this is not – when you're invalidating 80% versus 26% in district court and only 8% are said by the patent office to be bad patents – this is not about efficiently getting rid of bad patents. This is about destroying the patent system so that economic monopolists don't have to pay a patent monopolist for using their invention. There is no way that you can look at the statistics objectively and say that 80% of the patents that end up in IPR are bad patents. That is statistically impossible.
Well, we're coming up on the hour here, and Dean, are there any questions? Otherwise, I do want to ask the...
Let me, Brian, open the floor to questions and see if anybody wants to ring in. In a moment, we'll all see an announcement that will say that the floor is on. After you hear that, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your phone. We are running a little bit behind here. We do have one question, Brian. Could we want to try and get this question in before we adjourn?
Yes, yeah. Go ahead.
All right. Let's turn
Epstein
to the
caller.
Go ahead, caller.
Hi. Richard Epstein has been saying that the problem with the administrative state is that it gets to be the legislature by creating its rules, the enforcer by enforcing the rules, and the judge and jury. And so it takes all three judiciary branches and combines it into one. And he says there's nothing in the Constitution that says that you can combine Article 1, 2, and 3 in the same person or the same entity. It seems to me that this IPR system is actually doing that, in that the Patent Office creates the rules and then judges the dispute on the rules and on what they've done. So it's giving all three branches the legislative, the enforcing and judicial branches to one entity, and having a court system decide whether a patent is valid or not at least takes one of those things away from the Patent Office.
So actually, can I jump in here? This is Greg. I realize that I'm going to take off my federal Indian law scholar hat and put on my legal historian hat for a moment. One of the interesting things about watching this attack on the IPR, and I think the criticism of the administrative state more generally, is that actually in my research on the early federal land system, there were routinely these administrative tribunals that were created to adjudicate land rights, and they actually had many of the features that Michael was criticizing. Now we can question, you know, should as a matter of policy, but I do find these attacks on the constitutionality intriguing. If the founders thought that these sorts of administrative tribunals were unconstitutional, they seem to have been awfully fond of them themselves.
Oh, Brian, this is Dean. Any final thoughts before we adjourn?
Well, I guess I'll let the speakers. My last question is: how do we, if you care to make a prediction, how do we expect the PTAB to rule here? Will they acknowledge the tribe's sovereign immunity, or say that it does not apply here, either because tribal immunity does not apply to the PTAB, or in the specific circumstances of this case, it does not apply? Can we get a
This is Michael. I don't know how they're going to do it, but they're going to deny the motion to dismiss. They will make up some pretextual reason to do it, because that's what they politically, the PTAB is a political body. And politically, that's what they've been told to do, so that's what they're going to do. They did the same thing in the University of Minnesota case. They're going to get reversed. The two ways available to them, supposedly, would be that there's some sort of a waiver because there was a lawsuit filed. That does not work under the Tejet case I argued and won at the Federal Circuit or the Supreme Court case. The other way is to say that the underlying transaction with Allergan is invalid or void. That, again, there is no precedent for a third party being able to attack the transaction of a sovereign as invalid. A sovereign can the sovereign decides what contract is valid to the sovereign, not some third party. But anyway, whatever happens, I'm absolutely sure the PTAB is going to rule against the tribe, and I'm absolutely sure they're going to get reversed on appeal if the law, you know, remains, unless somebody wants to overturn some Supreme Court precedent and some Federal Circuit precedent in the process. But the law is crystal clear. There's no chance following the law that the tribe should lose, but they will lose because the PTAB is political, not legal.
Aaron?
I'm going to take the easy way out and say, given the University of Minnesota case that Michael was talking about, I assume that's the direction they will go in this case as well.
Greg?
So, as a general rule, I think, unfortunately, all too often, tribes end up losing. That seems to be the track record. But I strongly agree with Michael that I think the precedent is on their side in this case. Distinguishing it will be hard, but you know that doesn't mean that they won't do it. I think some of the discussion I've seen suggests you know they might go in that direction, and that's a little worrisome.
Well, I want to thank all of our speakers for sharing these thoughts and having a lively discussion today, and thank everyone that dialed in to join.
Well, and this is Dean Reuter. I'll join you, Brian, in thanking all three of our speakers and give special thanks to you, our moderator, Brian Pandya. I also want to thank the audience for dialing in and for sharing your time with us. A reminder to our audience to check the website and monitor your emails for schedule of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.